This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
As SADC, we agreed to assist Mozambique militarily to fight insurgents in Cabo Delgado. There are financial implications and we are going to share the cost.
That's Botswana's president, Bokwetsi Masisi, under decision by the regional group to provide military support against the Islamist insurgents in Mozambique. Details coming up. Also, the UN has called for an urgent investigation into an airstrike which has killed and wounded dozens of people in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is under pressure to end the jihadist violence in the country's northeast. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As Ethiopians voted in national elections and counted the ballots this week, reports emerged of fresh fighting and rebel advances in the country's volatile Tigray region. The French news agency AFP reports the Ethiopian Air Force conducted an attack on a busy market in Tigray on Tuesday, killing and wounding dozens of civilians. Ethiopia's military spokesman, Colonel Getenet Adane, admitted to AFP that the Ethiopian National Defense Force carried out the operation, but insisted it did not target civilians. He claimed those who were attacked at the market in the town of Togogo were rebel fighters in civilian clothes. The UN has called for an urgent investigation. The US said it was gravely concerned by the reported fatalities, with State Department spokesman Ned Price calling the attack a reprehensible act. European Union policy chief Joseph Borrell said the bombings add to the appalling series of violations of international humanitarian law and human rights in Tigray. The fighting in Tigray and its impact on civilians has damaged Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's standing as a peacemaker and reformer. But his administration has remained defiant in the face of international criticism. Germany and the United Nations brought together 17 countries yesterday to discuss how to establish a lasting peace in Libya. The Berlin II conference issued a long list of conclusions on political progress in Libya, security after ceasefire, and the need for all foreign mercenaries and forces to leave. Libya's transitional leadership was joined by foreign ministers from Egypt, Turkey, Tunisia, Algeria, France, and Italy, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and senior officials from Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and others. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the conference's conclusions with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I would say there is nothing really new in these conclusions. The final document does not directly mention a single country except Libya. Turkish Minister of Foreign Affairs Cavusoglu nevertheless expressed reservations about the sentence, "All foreign forces and mercenaries need to be withdrawn from Libya without delay." His push for delay foreign forces failed in the face of Egyptian resistance. I would say it is really cynical for Turkey and for Russia and for several others to reaffirm our commitment to refrain from interference in the conflict or in the internal affairs of Libya. During the discussion before, all sides repeated their calls for a withdrawal of foreign forces and mercenaries, the arms embargo, the December elections and so on. But none of the burning issues were directly addressed, like who are those forces? Who are the embargo breakers? Who is delaying the preparations for the elections? UN Secretary General Guterres said in a video message, correctly, the election timetable is in jeopardy.
The Associated Press said that a senior U.S. official speaking on condition of anonymity said Russia and Turkey tentatively agreed behind closed doors to begin a process of removing foreign fighters. The official said the deal is not yet done, but they are prepared to discuss an incremental withdrawal of about 300 soldiers each. What do you make of that?
Yes, that's correct. There are ongoing US-driven talks in the background between Turkey, Russia, and others involved in the deployment of the Russian mercenaries in Libya. A withdrawal of 300 on each side would be quite symbolic. It would not change anything really on the military balance, but it would be a very positive sign. If in a later stage, in the next step, especially all the Syrians, but also the African mercenaries would be withdrawn from Libya, the offensive capabilities on the ground would be significantly reduced. This would be a signal that especially the Turkish-supported Operation Volcano gives up on a plan for a military solution, for an attempt to take the oil crescent and the east by force. The LNA, on the other side, doesn't have any realistic offensive capabilities whatsoever to threaten Tripolitania anyway, at least as long as the Turks are in Libya. But regarding a final end state, a complete withdrawal of Turks and Russians is tied to each other and unlikely for the time being. So this is right now about lowering the military capabilities on both sides to end any kind of offensive thinking.
Speaking earlier Wednesday ahead of the conference, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, "We share the goal of a sovereign, stable, unified, secure Libya free from foreign interference. For that to happen," Blinken said, "national elections need to go forward in December, and that means urgent agreement is needed on constitutional and legal issues that would guide these elections." How feasible is that?
The Secretary of State is very right, but the problem is that the talks about the constitutional basis for the elections and the legal issues are deadlocked. The Islamist-dominated High Council of State, the Muslim Brotherhood, and many influential clerics call for a referendum on the flawed draft constitution, knowing, but not saying, that this would make elections in December impossible. In the case of a quite likely rejection of the draft, the elections would be probably delayed for years. The same group of people is strictly against a direct presidential elections, I guess because they fear that none of their own candidates would have a chance to win. On the other side, the House of Representatives Chair Aguila Saleh and many of his representatives, the High National Election Commission, and also many of the civilian society, especially in Tripoli, want to continue to the December elections with the amended constitutional declaration from 2011, which saved as a foundation, as a basis for the elections in 2012 and 2014. And they insist to have the presidential elections as direct elections by the populations. What is critical is that none of those who have a say in the way ahead towards the elections were represented in Berlin, neither the Libya Political Dialogue Forum, nor the House of Representatives, nor the High Council of States, nor the influential clerics. So it is nice that everyone agreed in Berlin on holding elections in December, but the practical impact of this is unfortunately next to nil. The HOR and the High Council of State would agree to this easily.
That was Wolfgang Poschta, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Botswanan President Mokgweetsi Masisi, who is also the chairperson of the SADC organ on politics and defense, says Southern African nations will share the cost for sending troops to help in Mozambique's troubled Cabo Delgado region. The decision to send military support was made after a SADC summit in Maputo this week. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Bokandisi Dube has the details.
Masisi told media in Habrone yesterday that SADC countries will share costs of intervening in the conflict.
As SADC, we agreed to assist Mozambique militarily to fight insurgents in Cabo Delgado. There are financial implications and we are going to share the cost as member states. At the SADC Secretariat, we'll work on the budget. We will contribute as per each member's financial means.
Masisi says Mozambique concurs with the decision to send troops to Cabo Delgado, where Islamist insurgents have been launching deadly attacks in the oil-rich region. Mozambique President Filipe Nyusi was reportedly opposed to foreign boots on the ground as SADC pushed for military intervention. Masisi says the regional troops' aim is to restore peace in Cabo Delgado, but if confronted by insurgents, they'll fight back.
Our troops are not going to war, but if the war comes to them, they will fight. If the insurgents attack the locals, what the SADC troops will do is to help the Mozambican army repel the attack.
The regional body is expected to send a 3,000-strong force. According to a SADC expert report, three light infantry battalions of 620 troops each and two special forces squadrons of 70 troops each will land in Mozambique. Two attack helicopters, two other armed helicopters, and two utility helicopters would provide air support to these combat ground troops. The SADC force would also include two surface patrol ships with helicopters on board, one submarine and one maritime surveillance aircraft, according to the report. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Some of the public money allegedly plundered from state-owned enterprises in South Africa during the administration of former President Jacob Zuma may be linked to a convicted money launderer. That's the testimony of a financial forensic investigator at inquiry into corruption allegedly orchestrated by Zuma and three Indian businessmen brothers in the latter part of Zuma's government from 2009 to 2018. In a process known as state capture, Zuma and the Gupta brothers allegedly appointed allies to steal billions of dollars from government entities such as South Africa's railway service on their behalf. Darren Taylor filed this report.
Paul Holden of the London-based Shadow World Investigations non-profit organization has spent the past few years tracking the money stolen from South African public corporations. This week, he testified for several hours via video link before the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. He told the commission that Atul, AJ and Rajesh Gupta channeled funds to offshore companies connected to convicted global money launderer Altaf Al-Hanani. US authorities arrested the Pakistani in Panama in 2015. They linked his operations to several terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda, and to organized crime groups around the world. He was sentenced to more than 5 years in a U.S. prison and was freed a year ago. Holden says the U.S. government has placed sanctions on Al-Hanani and his many businesses. Essentially, says Holden, the Al-Hanani network cleaned dirty money that had been stolen from South African taxpayers for the Guptas and, by extension, Zuma.
I think the most disturbing feature of this is that the US investigation established that the Al-Hanani network, the money laundering network, was being used for a vast range of heinous criminal activities. It was laundering money for multinational, international drug cartels, and was also involved in receiving, dissipating, and laundering funds for terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda.
Known as the Zondo Commission, the inquiry board has been investigating allegations that former President Zuma and the Guptas colluded to divert government funds for their personal benefit. The Gupta brothers own a number of businesses in South Africa, but now live outside the country. Zuma and the Guptas have repeatedly denied the accusations leveled at them. Zuma has said they're motivated by politics. Holden testified that the Guptas set up a spider web of companies, mostly in Hong Kong and China, to process stolen South African funds. The investigator says the Guptas circulated the money through a huge array of business entities across the world to keep it hidden from authorities.
We can see the operation of two vast international money laundering networks that are operating abroad, but which are playing a vital role in laundering the funds of criminal enterprises in South Africa. The criminal networks used by the Gupta enterprise were closely related, if not the same, as the ones paying out to the Al-Hanani network.
At one stage, says Holden, the Guptas used a suspected South African crime boss to launder money stolen from the country's power company, Eskom.
The Gupta enterprise, in making use of its various money laundering networks, was employing individuals who were involved in very violent and seemingly organized crime in relation to the importation of illicit substances, and were engaging in what appears to be semi-gang activity. And I think it's quite disturbing that the funds that ultimately emanate from the taxpayer through Eskom transit out of South Africa via the hands of this organized crime network.
The Guptas are reported to be based now in Dubai. The South African government is trying to get them extradited to face numerous charges. Zuma is expected to go on trial soon on a long list of counts, including corruption and money laundering. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Gender-based violence has been described as a second pandemic troubling many South African women. Many pregnant women reportedly face abuse even during their most vulnerable time, including from midwives in the hospitals that are supposed to care for them. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Nomangala Dlamini, a mother of two, was very excited when the doctor confirmed she was pregnant with their second child. However, on the day of delivery, her excitement turned into a nightmare.
Experience labor pain at night. I hired a private car and rushed to the local clinic because ambulance takes time to arrive. When we arrived at the clinic, they told us no private cars were allowed to enter the gate and no wheelchairs will come out. So I had to walk while I was in pain. They checked me and I was told to go to the delivery room, which I had no idea where it was.
Lamine says she finally gave birth on her own while nurses watched television next door with some busy on their cellular phones. 40-year-old Nomazwe Hadebe had a similar experience, one of neglect, including emotional and verbal abuse.
And when I was giving birth to my second born, it was just that issue of, what are you doing here? Why are you having so many kids? That's why you cannot succeed. And from the admin, the ladies were speaking language that I don't understand, and they were so rude.
31-year-old Florence Pitikwe says her warning that the baby was coming was ignored by nurses and told to wait at the reception area. When they finally took her to the delivery room, it was too late and she gave birth on the floor.
When they were busy doing their stitches after the damages, that's when I felt a very big slap. That, why are you not opening your legs? How are we going to do the stitches? I was shocked.
Some of the women report that after giving birth, they were sterilized against their will because they were too poor to have children or were HIV positive. Worse still, some had their babies swamped while others went missing. Beatrice Mutali works at the United Nations Population Fund. She says the experiences of these and other women have left devastating scars that will require a lot of counseling and support.
Clearly, it indicates that there is work for us to do. There is work for those of us who are involved in standing for the reproductive health rights of women. But we also need to work with health providers. We need to work with the midwives to really educate them, and we really have to make sure that this does not occur again.
An assessment of the country's maternity mortality rate covering 2014 to 2016 established that 61% of deaths were due to poor care during antenatal, intrapartum, and postnatal periods. Another study carried out by the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the School of Public Health at the University of Pretoria reveals that pregnant women experienced physical abuse, including being slapped and pinched for not pushing hard enough during childbirth. Like many of these women, Pitikwe, who was slapped, says she did not report the mistreatment, fearing there could be further victimization or that no action would be taken, as is the case with similar incidents in government hospitals. The government has previously urged such incidents to be reported. According to government guidelines for maternity care in South Africa, healthcare workers must show respect and empathy towards women regardless of poor working conditions or alleged unsafe behaviors of women during labor. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new UN report indicates Islamist insurgency in northeast Nigeria killed nearly 350,000 people as of the end of 2020, with children younger than 5 accounting for more than 90% of the fatalities. The report, titled assessing the impact of conflict on development in northeast Nigeria, says the full human cost of the war is 10 times higher than previous estimates. News reports say the conflict with Islamist group Boko Haram and Islamic State's West Africa province has spawned one of the world's worst humanitarian crises with little sign of ending. The study says if the conflict continues to 2030, more than 1.1 million people may die. President Muhammadu Buhari is under pressure to end the violence. Some Ugandan residents living near the DRC border have welcomed their government's support for construction of roads in their neighborhoods. Many are optimistic the project will boost regional trade. Others remain skeptical. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Although the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, is Uganda's number one trade destination, most roads linking the two countries are largely impassable and have left many traders stranded. Maseru Katembo is a cross-border coffee trader.
Sometimes people carry coffee or cocoa on their backs through the border up to customs from DRC.
The presidents of Uganda and DRC last week commissioned tarmacking 223 kilometers of roads stretching from Mpondwe and Bunagana in Uganda to Beni, Butembo and Goma in DRC. It is hoped the roads will ease cross-border business. Patrick Ngeresa is from Uganda's Kasese district.
But because of the poor infrastructure, Congolese have not been able to transport enough or export enough from DRC up to Uganda, affecting also Ugandans because some lorries have not been carrying enough cargo up to DRC with the fear that the roads are poor. Despite the fact that there's some business going on, but it is not enough as it could have been, as it will be when the road will be constructed.
John Musinguzi is Commissioner General, Uganda Revenue Authority. He says trade between Uganda and DRC is projected to flourish once the roads are improved.
Uganda exports goods worth about half a trillion for the last financial year, 2020, to DRC. That can easily quadruple or even times 4, 5, or 10 once the road is good. Because once there is no access by road, then you leave the DRC market to far distant goods from Europe.
But some question Uganda's investment in the construction of DRC roads, given the sorry state of most of its own. Stanley Baluku is a social analyst.
Poor country like Uganda can afford to spend trillions of shillings or billions of shillings developing the infrastructure of another poor country. Maybe it's a nice example of south-to-south cooperation. But it might be a question as to how Uganda's road network, still very poor, very basic, can leave a gap for a road network for another country.
The project comes as DRC is making a case to join the East African Community. The ESC Council of Ministers are expected to give their final position by the end of the year. Uganda is more interlinked with the DRC than any other ESC states and stands a better chance to benefit from its admission into the regional bloc. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.